Hello, I'm here with Anders Helmersson. So let's start. When did you decide on acoustic piano, progressive rock and jazz as your prime influence? And when did you begin to mix all three and find your own signature that you call progressive fusion?
I think this is a pivotal question. And quite interestingly, I have in all my life as a composer been drawn to genre bending, or let's call it genre fusion. The term progressive fusion is my own expression, and it might emphasize sort of the mix of jazz rock, which was the music style that came up when I was a kid, you know, with artists like Chick Corea and all that. And at the other hand, the more experimental rock music, which today is called progressive rock, like for instance the band Yes. I used to love Yes, and I still do. But to mix those kind of genres, it might be like mixing milk and lemon. But for me, it was natural. I might be against the stream, but I love the keyboard player Patrick Moraz, who joined Yes and later was fired and replaced by Rick Wakeman, trying to jazz up Yes. You know, nobody I knew could understand how I could like him, but he was an enormous inspiration for me. Actually, I think no other musician have meant more for me than him, and in particular his album The Story of I. Genre bending is something that people, especially in the jazz genre, is regarded as an infringement and a very immoral thing to do. You can never imagine what insults I've heard, not at least from critics. Later on, I added to the word acoustic, so the term or genre acoustic prog fusion is a quite a good description of what I'm doing. I think the acousticization is the reaction against technology that made me feel confined and locked in, particularly when playing live.
When your debut album, End of Illusion, released in 1981, was eventually discovered by progressive rock aficionados in France and Japan in the 90s, did that come as a surprise to you?
Yes, actually I think it was. I had decided to leave the music business behind to study medicine, and then I started to receive lots of phone calls and email and mail from people all over the world. Later I got also a label calling me to make a release of the album, so I wondered really what was going on, and then I forgot about it. But the album sold pretty well, and later on when I decided to start producing again, I got royalty funds to enable me to record my second album called Fields of Inertia. And that was just in the time when the analog recording had been replaced by digital, and the world in the music business, music technology had a completely different map.
Did you work on End of Illusion start as progressive rock, as a progressive rock album, or did you at that time already try another new way, like the progressive fusion of Quantum House Project?
Well, when I worked with the End of Illusion, I had no intention of becoming a live artist. I wanted to be a recording artist only. I wanted to invite guest musicians and produce progressive fusion with the means available at that time. I remember being very influenced by Alan Parsons. and in particular his album Robot Eye. You know, Alan Parsons, he was Beatles and Pink Floyd's studio engineer and later became an independent producer, an artist too. Funny enough, I met him at the Abbey Road Studios just a few years ago, and I think then I realized how much he meant to me as an inspirational source when I did the End of Evolution. And at that time I also realized how my encounter with a digital recording made me change view of the concept of music production as such. I mean, now recording albums is of less importance, and performing live in the present is what music is all about. And that is my position right now. But it was not then.
Really?
But I think that Patrick Moraz's story of I and Alan Parsons' Robot I makes me think that next album will also be something with I.
When and how did you start to get interested in quantum physics? And how did this scientific theory or this science influence your last album, Quantum House Project?
Well, I have always been interested in popular science. I read a lot about it and I'm fascinated about it. But the term quantum house is actually the name of an association that I was a member of that were analyzing dreams. And we resided in a house in Houston in London called the Quantum House. We met every week to talk about dreams, and everybody in this party was interested in quantum physics, even though they were not scientists or anything. And I think I got interested too. And when this association vanished, I decided to bring the name with me. That's why. But I think, though, that the way I am writing music, the way I'm experiencing music, is scientific in a way. I believe that music is an organization of numbers in a way that proves that there is an underlying order in the universe, in the nature. And I'm thinking of numbers and organizations of numbers and combination of numbers when I write music. For instance, the Fibonacci sequence, that's something that's coming back everywhere in nature. It appears in biological settings such as the branching in the trees, the arrangement of leaves on a stem, but also on a piano. You can see that there is a combinations here. We have the black keys in a group of two. The first is a two, the second is three keys, and the white keys in an octave is eight, and together that is 13. So in one octave you have number one, two, three, five, eight, and 13, which actually is a Fibonacci sequence. And then it repeats itself in a new octave, in a new like a helix, like a spiral. And I don't say that has any importance. It just confirms that the way nature is shaped, and I do copy that many times when I'm writing. It's very mysterious for me, but it's also very, very exciting.
In Quantum House Project, you changed from electronic keyboards to a grand piano. Was the repertoire written for a grand piano from the start?
Yes. I wrote all the music like a piano piece and added bass and as a third voice. I also wrote a drum score, but as usual, drummers tend to make their own interpretation. But I wrote the piano part without attention to how difficult it was. And when I started to rehearse the music, I freaked out a bit because it was so difficult to play. It took a long time to learn. I engaged a classical trained pianist who is Russian, and a teacher at the Royal College of Music called Ilya Kondrajevsky. He helped me out with the fingering and supported me in the learning process, and I don't think that without him I would not have been able to play anything at all, what I'm doing now. So that those years was a very steep learning curve for me.
How did you compose for your previous albums? On a piano or on keyboards?
In my previous album, I guess I wrote the music in a different way. I wrote it with my synthesizers, and at the Triple Ripple album, I recorded it in a way to make it possible to play live, and it was written for my Regwood, four tone generators. So writing for four synthesizers means that you have to spend a lot of time, you know, sound chasing, which means tweaking the sounds, the sounds in relation to each other. So it's like mixing at the same time as you are writing. It's a very different way of working. But also, I would say, to create music for synthesizers is also an example of how mathematical music really is. And you can see the tone and the timbre in mathematical plots while you are tweaking. Like, for instance, by a knob to change a sustain or a filter, etc. And then by using extra controllers like keyboard, foot pedals, I even used the laser harp. It makes it possible to play four voices at the same time. But of course, yeah, music on my previous albums like Fields of Inertia and End of Illusion, and that was not written to play live at all. That was plain studio products.
The silence, the break between sounds, can be more explored through an acoustic piano. Did the use of this instrument have an influence on your compositions?
Yes, starting to compose for piano exposed me for different problems, mainly in terms of dynamics. I think I'm still searching for my own sound, and I have not yet found my own timbre identity. I have listened a lot to other artists with the same timbre, I mean with the grand piano, drums and electric bass, like Hiromi, Aziza Mustafa Saad, Tigran Hamasyan, etc. And I find it real difficult to understand how they can make it sound that good. So this instrument can be really difficult.
Why did you decide to record your second album, Fields of Inertia, in Rio de Janeiro, in Brazil?
Oh, well, that's a strange story. I was working on a cruise ship, actually, and I disembarked in Rio, and I decided to stay, and I got some friends in the music business, and I found a studio called BH Studios in Barra de Tijuca. And I felt that everything was set for a new album. I just had to come up with some new ideas, and that's how it all started.
Did working in a studio in Rio with Brazilian musicians influence your work? And did that experience surprise you?
I'm not sure, as those sessions was my first contact with the music business since I dropped out before. So this was, in a way, the new normal for me. And I was so baffled by the digital recording that it felt like I was on another planet. When I think back on it now, though, recording in Brazil was a cool thing to do. It was a true experience, not at least in terms of all the great people I met and how we struggled to get the recordings finished.
Amongst the Brazilian instrumentalists that recorded Fields of Inertia was Robertinho Silva, one of the best percussionist drummers in the world, known for his work with Milton Nascimento, Egberto Gismonti, Joao Donato, Gilberto Gil, and Wayne Shorter. I mean, what was it like to record with Robertinho?
Oh, Robertinho is a great musician and percussionist, but he actually did not play the drums on the recording. That was done by another guy. He only played percussion. I remember he came to the studio with a whole van filled with a percussion instrument. He unloaded it into the studio, and he made a sound check, and then he started to play, and that sounded very interesting, you know, very sort of primitive sounds. It sounded like you were in the middle of the jungle sometimes, and it triggered a feeling of something very exciting with, you know, berimbau, bandeiro, cuíca, and all those instruments. And he started to play, and we filled in, we followed him, we started the jam session, and that became a song on the album called Ground Zero. But Robertinho's percussion came back many times during that album. At some places he played a whole samba orchestra himself on a multi-track. A little story about that: after recording I went to New York to mix it, and at some places there were at not least an 80 tracks. And the studio, I remember, so this was in a time where the digital recording was in its cradle, and the sound card in the studio couldn't handle that many, that much information. So it all collapsed, and the sound engineer, he absolutely panicked. At the end of the day, we managed to sort Robertinho's files there, but this... funny enough, this became like spread like rumors among sound engineers in New York City. And eventually there was a music tech magazine called Sound on Sound, I think, something like that. And he wrote an article about this incident with the headline, "Sound Engineer Haunted by Inertia." But that was all due to the instrument, the Robertinho Silva's van.
Normally you write all your compositions in musical score, but you also accept suggestions from your band members during recording sessions. What kind of changes did their contributions add to your compositions? And what role does improvisation play in your music?
I think by the tradition, it's only the drummer who makes his or her personality into the music. At least in my music, the bass parts and also the piano parts are written and arranged. So if you start to improvise on that, they will be messy. But of course, I do have ad-lib parts. We always do in this kind of music. But talking about improvisation, to make a good improvisation, you need to be very, very well prepared, almost as good as when reading from a score. So it's hard to say what role it has, but of course, when writing, you always start with improvisation. I remember my first gig at Vortex in London. My piano tutor, who had been helping me with these pieces for almost a year, he came to the show, and afterwards he came up and asked me, "Hey, there was a piece here I never heard before. It was called Recital Z." And I said, "Why haven't you never played that for me before?" And I explained to him that, you know, this piece was improvised, and there was nothing written down on the score or anything, so I had never found any reason to play it for him. But he insisted, so in the following weeks he was going through this piece with me many times, and taught me how to build up the dynamics and things so on. And now, despite any scores, this piece is very elaborated and sounds almost the same every time you play it. Just like a written piece. So there is an arbitrary border between improvisation and composed music, but when you are allotting your ideas, every little semi-quaver gets its own place in the end.
Is there even a bigger space, more space for improvisations in your live shows?
Yes, when we play live, we play extended ad lib parts, as you normally do when you play live. Christian Grassard, he is this French drummer I play with. He used to take on a drum solo 10 minutes on every show, and that was very cool, and the audience used to love it. Myself, I'm a bit insecure to do long improvisation, so I'm not trained to play jazz. I do ad-lib parts, of course, but after a while, they become sort of molded into something much more less random than you would believe.
Your third album, Triple Ripple, was recorded as a trio together with the drummer Marco Minnemann and the bass player Brian Bella. But on your tour, you performed solo. I mean, how difficult or challenging was this switch from working and recording as a trio and then performing and going solo?
Yes, I was quite frustrated as I could not get any other musicians to join me. As the music was too complicated and complex, it would have been a nightmare for any musician to memorize all that. I honestly think Marco Minnemann is the only one who could do it. And when I asked him to join me, he said yes, but not until after 3 years, because he was fully booked. So, I decided then to do the show with Marco's and Brian's recording behind me and just play along. And I have to agree that it felt wrong. But I was so keen to play this piece live, so I did the show myself. And I was touring all over for a year or something. But after that, I came to the conclusion that my keyboard rig was too heavy, too complicated, and the music was too remote for most people, that they could not see any drummer, and they thought that I was playing playback myself. So I decided to scrap that project, the Triple Ripple project.
On your website, you share a video of your new composition, Ritual Eye Dance, that you recorded live with the drummer Senri Kawaguchi and the bass player Lukas Cila. Does this music reflect the concept for your next album?
Yes, the Ritual Eye Dance is a piece I've been working on for many years, and it have its obvious place on the next album. I love to play it as it feels very friendly for the fingers, comfortable to play. And I asked Senri Kawaguchi to do recording, to record the drums. And we recorded a lockdown video together with Lukas Cila. I think what she did on that recording was absolutely brilliant, and I will keep this video as a memory of our lockdown collaboration. And one fan wrote to me saying, "Smart snap, poke the chakra." And that was a very poetic thing to say, you know, chakra or points of energy that is used for meditation in the Hindu religion. And I really think that she poked the right chakras in this video recording. It was quite a forceful recording, but at the same time, sensitive and poetic, I think.
When will the new album be released? Do you already have the entire repertoire for it? Have you already recorded it?
Yes, A new album is coming up, and we have started recordings already. I think on my new album, I will have to find a new approach to dynamics. I'm working on that, and I'm very curious to see if it works. Maybe also I will add a tune from Quantum House album too, I'm not sure. I'm collaborating with Juan Philip. He is a product from Berkeley on drums, and also Lucas Schiller on bass. And I really hope that we will manage to come out for a tour after this corona pandemic. I'm really, really looking forward to that.
How would you describe your public profile at present? Did it change over time since your initial album?
Yes, of course. Swapping to a grand piano had an impact on my profile as my music became more sort of understandable and accessible for most people. Myself, I don't think that my music itself has changed very much before. And I've always been writing music for keyboard trio all my life, actually. But since then, of course, the timbre has changed, and now it could sound like a jazz trio more, and which means that I get access to all the clubs, which is great. That would have been impossible before. When I quit electronica, a lot of people, they were disappointed, but at the end of the day, I think I have more listeners now than then.
The encounter of jazz and modern classical inspired the great pioneering artists Bill Evans and the Modern Jazz Quartet, as well as arrangers Jill Evans and Gunter Schuller, to name a few. I mean, Schuller called this style the third stream. Since the 70s, European contribution to jazz has grown a lot, especially through ECM records. How do you see your work within this scenario? Could we call your progressive fusion the fourth string?
Fourth stream. Well, the third stream is a synthesis of jazz and classical music, I believe. And of course, I am classical trained and I do write neoclassical music. But also, I think that the music scene has gone through such a meltdown after this digital revolution. And the music genres have become more fragmented. And I believe that progressive fusion will remain niche music, and I am happy with that, of course. But I do like the synthesis of jazz and classical music, at this has similarities in timbre. And I think that Hiromi is a pioneer to play jazz music with a classical touch and a classical fingering. And that is quite interesting. An older jazz pianist, like, for instance, Errol Garner, used the piano almost like a percussion instrument. But to play with classical fingering really shaped perception. Imagine to mix Oscar Peterson with Franz Liszt. That sounds very exciting to me. So maybe that concept could end up in a fourth stream. Who knows?
You were born and raised in Sweden, and then you moved to England as an adult. Is there any Swedish identity present in your music? Or is the Swedish identity more prominent in your personality?
No, I don't think there is any Swedish identity as such in my music, and maybe more in my personality than, as you say. But I've always been looking abroad in my taste. But of course, there are many, many great Swedish musicians I adore as well. In particular, Esbjörn Svensson, and I'm still mourning his death.
Yes.
But more, ABBA, ABBA. I like ABBA, but that's not really in my sphere, not really my chakra. But I started my music career in Sweden, and I hope that I would be recognized there again, and maybe go back for some gigs in the clubs like Fashion, Nefertiti. That would be like a dream come true, really.
I really hope you will perform in Sweden again. How do you analyze the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on the music market?
I cannot analyze it differently than how it have affected our world in large. But it's very especially tragic for the event industry, of course. I mean, it's a disaster. You know, I had a gig in London's Kew Gardens on the 16th of March. I was aware that the coronavirus was getting more threatening. And I told the audience that what was going on was very frightening and scary, mainly because we don't know how it's going to develop. You don't know where it's going to end. You don't know. You don't have a crystal ball. I made a joke, and I said that in a few months, all kinds of gathering will be forbidden. People laughed, but 2 days later, the whole UK was in a lockdown. No more gigs. And for the moment, we are in the same situation. We don't know what the future look like. We don't have a vaccine. We don't have a crystal ball. And that's something we have to get used to. There are always people who try to take advantage of this lockdown, but this is an apocalypse. It affects us, everyone, and there is nothing we can do apart from just wait and see until it's over. And you don't know when that's going to happen. But maybe when you see this video, you know the answer to that question. But for the moment in time, we don't know, and it's quite scary.
Live music on the internet has been a relief for many people during these eternal times of lockdown and quarantine. As a musician, but also as a doctor, how do you see the role music plays in our lives from now on?
The subject of music and internet is just as apocalyptic as the coronavirus. It's just that it happened 20 years earlier. Now we found ourselves in a situation where we cannot travel, we cannot gather with other people, but we still have got the internet, which makes it possible to communicate with people at the other side of the planet for free and very easy. So the world is changing. And there is nothing called a music industry anymore. Music is a craft that uses internet as a medium. So if the world is going virtual, so should the music and the music business. And that's okay. But I think in my heart of heart, I am longing back to the time when you could pop into a music venue here, like here in London, Ronnie Scott's or Jazz Cafe, have a glass of wine and listen to some very, very good live music. So what's going to happen in the future is hard to say without the crystal ball, but I think that most people would appreciate to listen to music in vivo. And maybe in the future, after a long time of abstinence from gatherings and going to venues, people would sort of wake up from this Cinderella sleep and start to learn how to appreciate live music again, you know? And then the live music industry would flourish just like in the 80s. You know, history repeats itself, they say, so you don't need a crystal ball for that.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.